That means you have to be open to understanding what the community really is about, and not what you're assuming that it's about, not what it used to be about, but what, you know, how does that community think? What are they looking for? What are their needs? And getting past the assumptions that we all tend to carry with us. So, and the assumptions that the church has about who they are within the community, which are almost always somewhere between a little outdated and incredibly outdated. So,
the word evangelism sometimes creates a negative impression in the minds of many people. They have the idea of evangelism as someone standing on the corner of a street with a sign above them announcing that you have a chance to not go to hell if you listen to what this preacher has to say. Or it might be someone standing in an airport or a train station or a bus station handing out tracts. It might be also the occasion of where you answer your door and there's someone on your porch who wants to talk to you about have you found Jesus. We're going to have a conversation today about evangelism, and it's going to be none of those things. None of those things. Our guest today is the Reverend Tom Barlow. I'll get into his credentials in a few minutes, and I just want to say thank you for listening to us today. This is Dennis Shaw. I'm a retired elder in the Mountain Sky Conference of the United Methodist Church, and this is Mindful Leader. Thank you for being with us. Let me welcome you back to Mindful Leader. My guest this morning is Tom Barlow, Dr. Tom Barlow, the Reverend Dr. Tom Barlow. Tom is an assistant professor of Methodist Studies at the Iliff School of Theology. Tom is a Coloradan. He went a little while to undergraduate school at the University of Colorado, Boulder or Denver?
Denver, yeah.
Denver, University of Colorado, Denver. And he has an undergraduate degree from Colorado Christian University. He went to Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky. And my experience with Asbury people has been they are strong on leadership, and Tom definitely is. And he has a PhD from the University of Denver and the Iliff School of Theology. Congratulations there for that, Tom. He's also worked at the local church. He's had a 2-point charge in Wyoming. And most recently, he spent 3 years at Littleton United Methodist Church during the COVID crisis. Welcome, Tom. Thank you for having said yes to talk to us on Mindful Leader.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It's good to be with you.
When you and I did the run-up to this, we talked a little bit about what we might chat about, and the topic of evangelism came up, and you and I both sort of sparked on that a little bit, that we thought that would be potentially a good topic. And I understand that you teach a course at the Iliff School of Theology on evangelism. Is that right?
That is true. I have actually taught that for quite a while now. I'd have to look back at my records and see when I took that over as my solo course. I co-taught with another faculty member there. I've been teaching as adjunct at Iliff for, I think, 12 years now.
Yeah, I knew that.
And then just this year have taken a full-time faculty position, which is a 3-year term contract position. So the evangelism course that we've been teaching, Iliff always, I think, takes a slightly different approach to everything, which is one of the reasons I like the school. And we do in the evangelism course that we teach is for United Methodist students, although over time it has begun to attract other students as well. And what we try to do is really honor the heritage of mission within the Methodist tradition, with a sensitivity, of course, to the misuse of evangelism as a colonial tool. I mean, Iliff is very much about post-colonial studies and correctives to colonialism. But we also have expanded the way that we think about evangelism, or perhaps altered it a little bit so that it is highly practical. What I teach there in that course is focused on helping students think about their own faith narratives, why it is that they are studying what they're studying, which is they're working on a master's in divinity typically in order to go into ministry. What got them there and helped them think about how to share that story with other people? So it really is very focused on relational bonds, building that kind of bond. But in order to really think about that in effective ways, we give them tools to look at what the local context of the ministry is for whatever ministry or nonprofit they're serving. And so there we help them think about what local area demographics will tell them about the DNA of the community, the multiple DNAs, the multiple aspects of the communities around the church. And then I help them think a little bit about the DNA of the church itself. And I've done quite a bit of work in that for my own leadership and also some consulting over the years in that as well. It's hard to serve a local community if you don't take the time to understand where that community is and what it is that they're looking for. You really can't form relationships with individuals in the community terribly well if you have no idea who they are and what it is that they're looking for. So,
There's both the demographic of the church itself, but
right.
then part I think part of what you're driving at there is the demographic around the church. The podcast that we released on the 18th of December was with Mark Calhoun, and it focused quite a bit on context. But he didn't get in. He talked a little bit about a binder and some things like that. He talked about it as a philosophy. I have the impression that what you're doing with the course at ILUF is more oriented around tools. You're specifically focused on tools.
We get very, very practical. And in fact, the students do a project using one of the dominant tools, probably perhaps the dominant tool. I'm not trying to sell it or speak to the marketplace, but they utilize the tool that is the most common across the Methodist connection. And they utilize that to actually do a demographic analysis of their local area, and then think about what that tells them about sharing their individual stories with a dominant demographic segment of that community, and then also sharing their story with a non-dominant demographic segment of that community. So we really do help them think through, how to do it when the rubber hits the road, what it is that you do when you're actually out serving in ministry.
Well, the nature of this particular podcast, most of my listeners are United Methodist. Eventually, I hope to grow it out to a point where it's not necessarily so Methodist, but it's okay for you to say the name of the platform. It's all right.
Yeah, so I mean, the platform that we're using is Mission Insight because that is at one point, I'm not sure if this is still true or not, but at one point, every single conference in the United States had a active contract with Mission Insight. Now, this has been a challenge and a frustration for some of my students, and we've had to come up with unique ways to work around it. But even during during the time when I was being clearly told by folks who know that every conference had a contract, I would have students who could not find anybody in the conference who could help them get access to the tool. And then there are some conferences where there are specific individuals through whom you have to go in order to get demographic reports, and then you use what they give you. Here in this conference, which is Mountain Sky, we have a contract with Mission Insight, and we have documents that we share with folks who want access to that. The conference does. I'm not in charge of that. And so any individual who's legitimately involved with trying to figure this out can get their own access, and then we train our students to actually utilize it for basic and sometimes a little more than basic data gathering in order to understand their communities. So,
yeah, and I'll put a link to how you find out about that in the show notes. The conference does have it. I have an account myself, yeah. And I used it both in Colorado Springs and I used it in Utah, and it was a helpful tool for being able to get an idea, get a handle on certain things.
Yeah, and just to continue on in terms of how we help them interpret that, we've had a relationship now, kind of an informal relationship with Tom Bandy, who is Methodist clergy, and also, in my particular case, my field of study for the PhD was John Wesley and Paul Tillich, and Tom Bandy is one of the very few people that I've found who has studied both as well. And so Bandy has written a number of books that are extremely helpful in thinking through the nitty gritty of how to utilize the data that comes out of Mission Insight. He's written a number of other books as well on strategic thinking. And I was just realizing that there's a dedicated bookshelf in my office at ILIF with Tom Bandy's books on it, but
he's
that means I only have two of them here.
Yeah, he's
so
got about 30. He's written about 30 books.
Yeah, so, he's written a lot. And it's helpful stuff. The two books that we focus in on the most in the course are called See, Know, and Serve, The People Within Your Reach.
And I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah. And then also Worship Ways for the People Within Your Reach, which is... those are the two books we use in the evangelism course. And so that the first one helps you to think about broadly how it is you connect with people. And he kind of walks you through the meaning of what you discover in the demographic reports, although they're remarkably helpful reports just even without that. Uh-huh. In part because there are documents that he has written for Mission Insight that help to interpret the data. Really, really helpful documents for every single demographic segment. There are 70 plus of those.
Yeah, if you Google Tom Bandy and Mission Insight, he's got some role of helping them with the design and
yeah.
how it's all set up. He's not independent. He's a cooperative architect in what it is they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to put it, too. And there are these mosaic reports that he has written, which help to kind of lay out all of that data. But the other thing we help that we utilize that he's written is Worship Ways for the People Within Your Reach, which helps students think about what kind of worship experience, and that can be interpreted in a number of ways, that can take a number of different forms, are going to work with the demographic segments that they are trying to serve or that they want to attract. And, you know, one of the early conversations that we have in the demographics course is, I think there's a bit of a subtle difference. This is my philosophy. I don't know that it's necessarily Tom Bandy's, but there's a subtle difference between understanding who is in your area and how to relate to them. And also understanding who is in your area that perhaps your church will not relate to because the needs are just different. Subtle difference between that and targeting specific groups and trying to bring them in. And I mean, the extreme version of that is that there was a church over here on the west side of the Denver area 6 or 7, 8 years ago when my wife and I were first moving here, that had decided that they really wanted to shift their ministry to attract a younger crowd and did away with any services that weren't pretty modern, contemporary Christian kind of services. And what that did was disenfranchise a whole lot of folks who were there attending what were more traditional services. So they stopped doing them. And that spun off a lot of people who were looking for churches in the area. Sometimes perhaps churches need to make that decision, but that seems somewhat problematic to me.
What?
I should mention that when we're talking about those uses of the demographics, one of my former students and now a colleague in the conference who actually did a little workshop for us on Mission Insight a few years ago before COVID hit, who is a powerful minister of color, Jasper Peters.
Yeah.
Just an amazing guy.
Very dynamic.
Phenomenal student and phenomenal pastor. Pushed back on me a little bit because he said, you know, the one piece that he utilizes Mission Insight for that I wasn't ever mentioning was helping his congregation to understand the ethnic diversity right around their church more deeply and to understand who wasn't represented in the church that was in the community. And that wasn't something I was terribly focused on. And I, you know, there are moments of learning for all of us.
Yeah.
And that was a learning moment for me. I'm sure that this is an area of weakness for me in my ministry because I've never wanted to do something that is, that I know will actually marginalize or exclude people who have loved what that church has done in the past.
Yeah.
And the reason I say it's a weakness is I think in some instances, in order to keep the church alive, maybe that was something that needed to happen. I'm more into adding, and this is me being an optimist, I'm more into adding additional opportunities with different styles of whatever, worship or something else, than I am to into getting rid of things that already exist that people are really loving. And that's a fine line. And
I mean, part of the way I saw that was if something was an ongoing program and it was working and it wasn't causing us not to be successful somewhere else, I didn't worry about it.
Yeah.
I think the question I always had was, what does this do to our ability to be successful in other areas?
Yes.
But Sean Genright, in his book, The Four Pivots, talks about creating opportunities for possibility. What are mm-hmm. possibilities? Pivot towards possibilities rather than always operating in the negative. No, we can't do that. We haven't got it all the way through. One of the things, though, that Bandy does talk about is being willing, if you have to stop resourcing some idea.
He does, Yeah, I've
it's
he and
tricky.
I have, he and I have had conversations about that.
Yeah, Tom Barlow, the guy that shut down the children's Sunday school.
Right, yeah. It's
I'm kidding.
I don't know. It's just too painful for me sometimes to think about those things. And he's challenged me to think about that. You'd mentioned that I served Littleton United Methodist Church. There was actually one in between Wyoming and Littleton.
Yeah. It's where you
which
and I
was
were buds in Colorado
yeah,
Springs.
Good Shepherd United Methodist Church down in Security, Colorado, the south end of Colorado Springs. But when I came back into ministry after finishing out my doctorate at ILF NDU, I had offered to take a church. What I was doing at ILF was it was time for it to come to an end at that point. I was not faculty at the time. And I ended up then taking a larger church in Littleton, one of the top 10 or 12 in the entire four-state conference in terms of numbers. The former statistician that I'm talking to right now could probably tell
true.
me
It's true.
which.
I think they were like at one time fourth or fifth. They're
yeah,
a good-sized church.
They're a good-sized church. Doing that beginning in July of 2020, which as I will be happy to share with anybody, that was challenging in unexpected ways, but I literally came in during the lockdown.
I've actually quoted you on my podcast, Tom, where you've made a remark about people who have not led a church during COVID don't have any appreciation for what leadership in the church was all about.
It was nigh on to impossible, and it really turned into me getting them through the lockdown, not really developing the relationships that I would normally have developed during the first year. And then it kind of, you could never really reclaim those very well. And not being able to put together the some of the key leadership areas that really needed to come together for a thriving congregation. But 3 years there got them through COVID, got them reopened after COVID, and then did my best to kind of prepare the way for the next one in. But 3 years was about the max I could really do there and survive. So, yeah. So that was an interesting church. I did. I'm a big fan of clergy having somebody to coach them or mentor them, regardless of how much experience that they have in ministry. I'm a big fan of coaching. I've done that for a few, informally, not really formally. So during COVID, for probably at least half of those 3 years, I actually contracted with Tom Bandy as a coach, which I shared with him and some other folks who were gathered down in San Antonio a couple of months ago. That I probably wouldn't have survived even 3 years there without that kind of support and challenge and accountability. He's got a very gentle spirit. I'm not trying to sell his coaching approach. I don't know that he's got a lot of slots open. I was blessed to be able to avail myself of that. And it's not free. You really do contract. You pay for it. But it was so well worth it. But some of the conversations we did have, going back to where we were a few moments ago, were around after COVID is over, after this current crisis is done, are there ministries of this church or any church that need to be reevaluated in terms of whether they really need to still be there? The church that I had taken was a church that had a lot going on, and I wasn't really seeing anything that needed to go away. Of course, somebody else might look at it and have a different opinion, but
Well, my doctor of ministry is from Wesley Theological Seminary, and I will say to you that one of the things they emphasized there in that program was exactly what you just said. Don't You're not a lone ranger. Don't be in this alone. Find somebody you respect, and find somebody who will hold you accountable. Accountability is important, and they can challenge you in loving, kind, gentle, maybe not so gentle ways. Were at times that you need to rethink something. And I have found that wisdom to be profound.
I have two, and when I've done consultations with local churches, I have done consultations with local churches that I have not served, meaning I was brought in as an outside, the dreaded consultant who was coming in to help think things through. Frequently the outcome, not always, but frequently the outcome was that no real change ended up happening, and part of that was that the clergy who were actually doing the, leading the ministry were not really interested in anything past just the visioning events themselves. And I think it would be critical for somebody who has taken a church through that to then avail themselves of coaching to help them think about how to do the things that were identified during the consultation, and really follow through on the areas of emphasis that, in my experience, it generate just a lot of energy during the consultation, finding someone who can help you then get through the rest of that and actually accept the coaching and the accountability that sometimes a person who is preventing any kind of change in the church, very often the person is the person who's in leadership, the person at the very top. So,
My personal experience in ministry was just that the more I knew, the more I learned, the more I discovered I did not know, and how valuable that was. And it led to some measure of humility. And Bandy, in his book on strategic thinking, makes the comment that if you're really doing strategic thinking right, it leads to humility. Then his quote is, it's humble before the public, listening first and speaking last. Dennis, he's talking to you, observing before acting, empathic, rather than authoritarian. It doesn't presume to know best what people need, nor does it assume that people need what their church already has. That's profound. That is really profound. And that sometimes is the way you have to sort of lovingly, kindly tell people that what they're offering isn't what the community necessarily needs.
Yeah, and I've dealt with multiple churches, and of course, I've also had this opportunity to teach this course for so long and listen to the students having these aha moments as they go through the project, realizing that perhaps even the dominant segments around their church facility, what they think of as the church, which, you know, is really not what the church is, but the segments that are right around there are not represented at all within the ministry of the church because of shifts that have occurred over the course of decades.
Right.
And that every church that I've done work with, actually, unless they are very small and rural, do not really reflect the community around themselves. And
they've to some extent become outpost in the community.
Yeah, and there's a lot you can do with that, by the way, if you view yourself that way.
Yeah.
And if you're welcoming to those who are going to come and check you out and figure out how to connect with them, that can actually be a really helpful view. There's a whole sermon that I actually preached on that about outposts of the kingdom, which after my time at ILF, I might now preach as outposts of the kingdom. That, you know, if you really can kind of frame that and not turn it into some kind of problematic image of power, I think you can do a lot with it.
Yeah. I would do want to come to a bit of inspiration. I think I want to do a little bit of a contrasting with what our mind normally thinks about of evangelism. And evangelism, sometimes you think of it with people handing out tracts on public transportation, or people knocking on your door, leaving a tract in your mailbox or something like that. But that's not what Bandy is talking about with evangelism. And
it is absolutely not. And it's also not at all what we talk about in the course. The very first lecture that I do actually presents those stereotypes of what evangelism is understood to be, you know, all the way from the street corner preachers with, you know, signs saying, you know, repent or go to hell, all the way through, you know, Jim and Tammy Baker, all of that stuff is just kind of laid out for students to take a look at and to think about what evangelism really means. And throughout the entirety of the course, and we work on a quarter system, so this is 10 fairly intense weeks of study. Throughout the entire course, students are reshaping how they understand that term. And the final week, I kind of bring them back around to, you know, where are you now? I asked you where you were the first week and what sense you had of the word evangelism. Where are you now? I had one group of students, which would have been during COVID. So we weren't able to meet together face to face. So we were doing some meetings online, that actually really wanted to figure out how to reappropriate the word evangelical to be more like what, I mean, Methodism was an evangelical movement, but not in the way that that term is used today. Today, it's got a lot of baggage. So we went from the baggage of evangelism to the baggage of evangelical. And I had this entire group of students who just by the end of the course were trying to figure out how to reclaim that name, and get it away from the baggage that it's gained over the years of, you know, power and influence and judgment that is not about accountability. It's just about judgment and all of the negative stuff that is attached to that now. And again, I mean, when we talk about evangelism in the course, we're talking about something that is highly relational, where the relationship is the priority. Even if it's a fleeting relationship that's just formed in a coffee shop or something like that, but how to build upon commonality and share your own story of how, you know, again, for these students, why are they working on an MDiv? Why are they pursuing ordination in the Methodist Church? And help them think about how that story can then inform what others would probably refer to as testimony.
Well,
We don't use
Jerry,
that term in the class because it has baggage too,
yeah.
but that really is kind of what we're talking about. I mean, this is.
Well, Jerry Herships, who is an ILF graduate, and then Bob Kaler, who's an Asbury graduate, one of the things that those two had in common was that their presence in the community was regular and intentional, and in such a way that they wanted people to know who they were. So they wanted people to walk over to them at the coffee shop and say, "I understand you're the local Methodist pastor. I understand you're the they th that was a goal of theirs. They
Right.
wanted that to happen. They wanted to be have a person say, "Can I talk to you?" Let them initiate the conversation.
Yeah, and we still have students. I have not carried this forward as much as I probably should have, but when we had a adjunct named Mike Nickerson, who was teaching for us for a long time. He's now a retired elder in the Methodist Church, lives, I think, in the Pacific Northwest now.
He does. It's either Oregon or Washington. I can't remember which.
He instilled in the students this concept of not being a minister to the local church, but being a minister to the local community. And you can still hear that language in being used by students who took his courses.
Brad Larvick.
Yeah, he's
Brad
the one
Larvick,
I'm thinking of. Yep.
he doesn't say I'm appointed to call to Fort Collins first. He introduces himself as I'm appointed to the community of Fort Collins and I serve at Fort Collins first. It is
Which
go
is a
ahead.
beautiful way to put it.
It's
It just is,
fantastic.
and I think Brad's actually the first time that I heard that, and I think I'd asked him where it came from, and he said that came out of Mike. I probably need to think about incorporating that into my teaching now.
First time I heard Brad do it, I had goosebumps.
Yeah. Oh, it's just a gorgeous way to think about it. But again, that means you have to be open to understanding what the community really is about. And not what you're assuming that it's about, not what it used to be about, but what, you know, how does that community think? What are they looking for? What are their needs? And getting past the assumptions that we all tend to carry with us. So, and the assumptions that the church has about who they are within the community, which are almost always
Little
somewhere
foreign.
between a little outdated and incredibly outdated. So.
Part of the conversation I had with Mark Calhoun that we premiered on the 18th, I sort of asked him a question twice. It was one of those things where I ask it one way and then I ask it about maybe 10 minutes later, a subtly different word. But it was this, it went back to this idea of how do you gently, lovingly, kindly get people to understand that where they are is not where the community is,
Yeah.
and how you move them? One of the quotes that you and I both like is Frederick Buechner. I think is Frederick Buechner. He was Presbyterian. Am I correct? Is that what he was?
Yeah, I think so.
I
Yeah.
think he was Presbyterian. But he has this quote that you and I have heard different permutations of it. But it has to do with our vocation should be where our joy meets the world's greatest need. And Bandy talks about that as the related to the. He's talking more corporately. He's talking more around the church's greatest joy, where the people in that thing called the church, or maybe some teams within that, but it's related to serving the community, is what Bandy talks about.
Yeah, and he in the book See, Know, and Serve the People Within Your Reach, he talks about heartburst affinities, which are the things that really resonate deeply with the people who are within the congregation and which feed them, which bring them joy in ministering to others, which helps them to grow and to to experience, well, to put it in, John Wesley terms, to experience, it's a means of grace for themselves, right?
Right.
It's a means of experiencing God's grace for the individual doing it, as well as the person who's receiving whatever that ministry is, whether they know it or not. It is a means of grace for them as well. But yeah.
Well, I got a bit of an accountability thing. I was at Strathmore Hills in Colorado Springs, and there was a meeting that went on near me that Randy Jessen, who was the pastor then at Wilson United Methodist, which was about two Methodist churches away, he was at the meeting, and he called me on the phone, and he said, "Dennis, this is a meeting about serving your community, and I don't want to sound overly authoritarian, but you need to be here. And he held me accountable, and he held me accountable in love and in grace, and I got involved. And it was one of the most important things that I did at Strathmore Hills was helping lead on that activity. It was just, and what was interesting was, is that there was people in the Hilltop United Methodist Church that wanted to serve in that kind of ministry. All I had to do was just to figure out who they were and what the ministry was going to look like, because there was a community need. And it all arose from an accountability thing by Randy Jessen, who called me up and said, "Dennis, you need to be here. Next time we have this meeting, you need to be here."
I can totally see him doing that. Randy is the pastor who kind of brought me into ministry out of Broomfield United Methodist Church. My wife as well. He then performed our wedding. We go way back. He's with the Global Methodist Church now, but we still talk, and
He's a good guy.
hopefully always will. Yeah, he provided a powerful example of effective ministry leadership. For both of us. And there are times when I've been leading churches, when my wife is an elder, she's currently pastoring Heritage United Methodist Church here in Littleton. There are times when one of us will say something during a worship service, and it's like, I sit there and go, yep, we got that from Randy Jessen. We are currently channeling Randy Jessen. And he loved to talk about the life of the church, the opportunities within the life of the church, ways to connect within the life of the church. And we both still utilize that language. She utilizes it a lot. And every time she does, I hear Randy's kind of behind it. So.
Well, I think to some extent he epitomizes what part of what you and I are driving at here, which was he could get a sense that there was a community need that I wasn't aware of, and he was pointing me to that community need, and he was accurate. He was spot on. And by the way, there was people inside Strathmore Hills that once you said, "We want to do this over, we want to have this B Street food pantry," and there were all kinds of people that said, "We can't afford it, can't do it, blah, 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 whatever." All of a sudden, there was two or three people wanted to do it, and we entered a coalition got created. It was just a coalition of the willing, which included non-church members, and it's still going. And here it is, like 15 years later, and it's still going.
It's
It
remarkable.
is remarkable. And we saw it as an evangelism. And I looked at some things today, and there was some stuff on there on the Strathmore Hills page that talked about the B Street Food Pantry and how important it was to their ministry, what was going on. So evangelism isn't always knocking on a door and handing out a tract on Romans.
Is not. And I think most effectively, it probably never is. And if you look back at the history of the Methodist Church, the focus has always been on building relationships first, frequently by meeting the needs of the people, but don't start preaching at them until you've filled their stomachs. If they're hungry, they'll listen better. And so much of this was John Wesley, and so much of it was just built into the DNA of who we are. But initially we were a renewal movement within the Church of England, within the Anglican Church, calling people to, holiness of heart and life, and getting out of a head-based religion and into something that was actually made incarnate in the world. One of the terms that I use, I don't know if I got this from anybody else. If so, I don't remember who. But I have commonly used the phrase agents of grace when I lead churches. I encourage us to think of ourselves as agents of grace. And part of the way that I frame that is when I first come to a church, even as a guest speaker, guest pastor, I'll frequently preach on the Wesleyan understanding of divine grace, which has some unique aspects to it, including this idea of prevenient grace, the grace that goes before, the grace that invites us into relationship with God, the grace that works within us non-coercively to enable us to respond to God's invitation if we choose to, but it always gives us a freedom to just walk away if we want. And that as people of faith who are living out a life of grace, we hope, a life of authentic grace, that we get to be agents of that kind of grace in the lives of others. And
the wedding ceremony and the Methodist hymnal, at the end, after you've married the couple, you as the pastor turn to the congregation, turn to the gathered that are there, and you give them a charge. And the charge you give them is to go, now that you've witnessed this love here, go show love to those to whom love is a stranger. And I probably said that sentence 100 times. And every time I say it, my heart beats a little faster, because it conveys such a powerful idea. It's not about handing them a track on Romans. It's about living your life in such a way that people that know you're connected with God, you're part of the community of God. You're part of the reign of God.
Yes. And you know, our baptism liturgy as well, you know, it incorporates, when we're baptizing children, and for that matter, adults as well, this commitment on the part of the community to help them walk the path of faith, to help them grow. And I just keep kind of framing all of that around grace, and grace has been the focus of my ministry, my scholarship, for a long time now.
Well, the most popular of my podcasts that I've done on Mindful Leader has been Christy Kinnison's. And it's essentially a 45-minute talk of how grace has impacted her life. And I'm pretty sure it's popular because people have said, "Hey, you need to listen to Christy's thing on Dennis's podcast," and she really talks to the subject of grace and how powerful it is as a message. My own coming to the church, coming back to the church in 1991, was on Jesus touching the lepers. I'm not sure grace got mentioned as much as you and I are doing it here, but it was essentially on Jesus doing the countercultural thing of touching people that no one else would touch.
Right.
I was like, wow, that's powerful. So I have been, is there anything I didn't ask you that you were really, really prepared for me to ask, and I failed to ask it, that you want to get out there now?
You know, as we've been talking, I, you know, it's up to you who all you invite, you know, or invite back or whatever on your podcast.
My plan to invite you back.
Okay. We could certainly have some conversations around the framing of grace. I really do push that hard with my students. And one of the things that I've discovered in teaching as well as preaching is that when I do bring up this overall framing of grace in the Wesleyan heritage, no matter where I do it, I will have people saying afterwards, whether they are students or congregants in the pew who have just listened to a particular sermon or two that I preach, who will tell me that they've never heard that before, and that they're lifelong Methodists and they've never heard that before. It'd be fun to do that because that does inform how we think about leadership, or it should. It would be fun to talk about how to think about leading in the diversity of follower readiness, but that would be a whole different one. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we probably wouldn't have any shortage of
It
topics to
was
talk about.
frankly, a lot of the people that I've talked to in my first 15 or 16 are people that I plan to come back to again. And you were on that short list of people I'd like to talk to a couple of times. Zach Bechtold is holding me accountable that when I talk to him about the fifth time, I need to give him a t-shirt or a coffee cup or something.
There we go. Yeah. Like the Five Timers Club on Saturday Night Live. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I could, yeah. One of the other areas, what I'm really focusing in on right now in terms of some scholarly research is kind of tracing the beginnings of the division in Methodism before it became quote unquote united. And how that has played out in the splintering of the denomination, which could be a whole nother conversation as well.
Well, there's a lot of possibilities, I think, there. I met you the first time there over at Good Shepherd United Methodist. I liked you right off the bat. I've had a there's been times you and I've been apart for 2 and 3 and 4 years, and all it seems like whenever we get back together again, we
That's right.
just start talking right away as if there has been no
That's
separation.
exactly
We're
right.
part of the same tribe, I think. Tom, thank you very much. I appreciate the insight here, and for those listening, I do intend to invite Tom back. We have to sort of schedule him around the student load at ILEF. That's what we're doing now, but we'll get him back on here. I hope that people that are listening will take an opportunity to try to get mindful leaders scheduled onto their own pods their podcast service. I use Overcast, but we are on iTunes. Don't hesitate to take a look and send me a note at Dennis, Dennis, at Mantuan, Mantuan dot org. A person from Mantua is a Renaissance person, and I fancy myself as a Renaissance person. That's where that comes from. Tom, thank you very much, and peace be with you.
And with you as well. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. God bless.